Hello and welcome to the first ever Engineers Against Poverty in Conversation with podcast. I am John Hawkins, and in this series, I'll be providing a platform to a wide range of voices from around the world who you may not normally hear from to discuss some of the critical and sometimes unfashionable issues in the world of infrastructure, engineering and development. This is a hugely significant time following the conclusion of COP26 and the debate about whether we can keep the rise in global temperatures to under 1.5 degrees. And how we fund the adaptation of infrastructure to minimise the effects on the poor. In July, the G7 committed $100 billion in investment to support emerging economies. And to our surprise, buried in this text, the G7 communique was some shared values about looking at things like environmental issues, transparency and labour standards. And this really grabbed our attention. And who better to discuss this than our own Dr. Jill Wells? Jill is someone very familiar to any EAP audience and was recently described by a senior official at the bank as a legend, and who would disagree? And in a long and distinguished career, Jill is the essence of what EAP is all about, continuing to raise unfashionable issues on the development of the construction industry and, for what she is best known, promoting the rights of construction workers. When I first travelled to Tanzania, it was an unusual trip, really due to being really shown from much of a distance the perilous conditions of construction workers working in the blistering heat and humidity of Dar es Salaam. So welcome, Jill. You first started working in the construction sector back in the 1960s in Kenya and Tanzania before moving on to the ILO. What drew you to the conditions of the construction workers?
Oh, good morning, John. I have to admit that when I first started looking at construction in Kenya in 1967, I was responding to the demand of the government of Kenya, who were asking what to do about the capacity or lack of capacity in the construction industry. I worked for 2 years examining, researching the construction industry, including building materials supply. And then I was asked to go to Tanzania and do something similar. So I worked both for the government of Kenya and the government of Tanzania in advising them on how they might build their construction industry. So it was not at that time so much about the labour force. The important thing was actually having the capacity to implement their major development programmes. And they were countries with very different philosophies. In Kenya, they were very keen on promoting the private sector. In Tanzania, they were very determined that they were going to do everything by the government. So it was a very interesting period. I spent 5 years in East Africa and then returned to the UK.
And then how has the industry, you know, particularly in that part of the world, changed over the last 20 years or so? And what has this meant for the construction workers?
Yes, I would say, yes, it's continuing to change. 20 years is really, really not enough. Can I just go back to 1970? When I came back from Tanzania, I actually worked for a construction company in Cardiff. This was a really substantial company responsible for most of the public buildings in Cardiff City. They'd been in existence for almost 100 years, a really substantial firm. They employed almost everybody that was needed to complete the construction project and some very big projects. They had a joinery, they had a stone yard, they had an electrical department, and everybody was employed directly. In 1973, probably you don't remember that, John, but back in 1973, there was a big explosion in the Gulf with the rise in the price of oil and a big, big, big expansion of construction activity in the countries of the Gulf. Everybody was going off to the Gulf to work. And somebody asked my husband, who became my husband, who was the managing director of the company I'd gone to work for in Cardiff, why aren't you going to the Gulf? And his response was, well, you can't employ Rhondda Valley bricklayers in the Gulf. And so the company existed there with local labour, employing local labour. The difference from the way the industry is today is so enormous, it's almost impossible to comprehend. So I would say 50 years. Certainly by 1995, One could see very, very, very big changes in the industry, and these continued. I did two major reports for the International Labour Organization, one in 1996, which looked at migration of workers from around the world to work in the construction industry, starting off, of course, with the Gulf countries, which had no local labour or very little local labour. And so this was the beginning of the mass migration of workers to work in construction industries. And then I did another study in 2001, which was looking at the changes in the way in which these workers were being employed in covered virtually all parts of all countries in the world, from the very richest countries to the developing countries. And what was discovered in the study in 2001, and it's still actually cited by many people because it was prescient, it actually explained what was happening in the relationships of employment in the industry at that time. And this has continued, the trend has continued, and in the last 20 years, it has got even stronger. Basically, what it consists of is contractors outsourcing their subcontracting most of their specialized tasks, which has always been the case, but also outsourcing most of their labor supply to companies, small companies supplying labor for short-term projects, temporary labor agencies. This has happened everywhere. It was always the situation in many developing countries, but the change to indirect employment of workers was most dramatic, certainly in the industrialized countries, the United States, in Europe, in South America.
That's very interesting. I mean, you mentioned the Gulf there and the reports from kind of 20 years or so ago, and you spend a lot of time in the last few years looking at the Gulf, really triggered by the awarding of the World Cup to Qatar, having a dialogue with kind of the ILO and the human rights community, and really that kind of focus. From your perspective and the kind of the time you spent in the Gulf and Qatar particularly, what was the most important issue that you've identified?
Without any shadow of doubt, the most important issue I identified was the fact that the construction workers were not receiving their wages. They were not receiving their wages on time. Nearly all the complaints by construction workers with the government was about late payment of wages. And late payment of wages is a really serious crime in its own right. If you think about it, if you're working hard on a construction site, in very difficult conditions, and you're not getting your wages at the end of the month, you can, first of all, not send any money back to support your family in the country from where you've come. But also, it's at the same time, it's very, very common in this global industry sending construction workers around the world, that you have to pay sometimes quite a high price to obtain a job. So you're therefore in debt. Debt mounts up, and withholding wages, forcing workers into debt, is one of the most important manifestations of forced labor. The ILO recently has done a major study on and shown that the construction industry is responsible for the vast majority of instances of forced labor among migrant construction workers. So not getting paid your wages when they are due is really serious. But of course, if you're not paid your wages for several years, it's very unlikely that you're going to get them. You might suddenly be fired, and reclaiming your wages from all those months that you haven't been paid is almost impossible, especially for migrant workers who sometimes have problems with the legality of their presence in the country.
I think that's very interesting. I think sometimes we forget, particularly if you're kind of, I think, in the civil society sector, there's a reason why people move from South Asia to the Gulf, or from Eastern Europe to Western Europe. And, you know, there's a kind of focus on the employment conditions, but there's almost a, they forget that there's a reason why people move. It's about they want to earn a living, they want to earn more money. And I think sometimes that we kind of get that gets lost. And I think you kind of shared with me a couple of papers recently. And then I look back at another paper you wrote with our colleague Maria Prada about kind of wages and the supply, the complications of the supply chain. And I thought what was really fascinating about this was really around, there's this kind of perception, there's this binary choice between companies, good companies, and bad companies that practice modern slavery. And it's a lot more complicated than that. It's not that black and white. I just wonder if you could kind of talk a bit more about that, the kind of work you, the kind of the these papers, and really how do we start better understanding supply chains and really the responsibility of companies to ensure that workers get paid.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things that we found in Qatar, where we interviewed about a dozen major construction companies, is that they really did not have any idea what was happening down further down in their supply chains. In Qatar, there's a long subcontracting chain from one to another of suppliers of labour. And the ones at the very bottom, the people at the very bottom of the chain, they are waiting for the payment to come down from the principal contractor, from the client. And this payment doesn't come. And these companies are very, very small companies. They have very little capital behind them. Many of them were actually previous migrant workers themselves. And so it's virtually impossible to know as a major company sitting at the top of this chain, what is happening further down. And this was repeated to us over and over again. How can we find out whether the construction workers are being paid or not? Because if the construction workers are not being paid, they will do one of many things. First of all, they might start to slow down, to not work very hard. Secondly, they might actually, and this happens very much in other parts of the world, to steal materials, steal goods. Eventually, there will be industrial unrest and they will go on strike. And in the Gulf, they've gone on strike several times over the years. And this is obviously very detrimental to the progress of the project. So major contractors don't know very often what is done in their supply chains. And they really, really need to know. So there's all sorts of policy recommendations that flow from this, which we are now currently trying to put together. I mean, one of the main things is to actually get a hotline so that workers are not being paid can let people know at the top of the construction chain, and not just the government, but the actual employers at the top of the chain. Then, of course, there's many people saying that you should actually go back to a direct employment. This is unlikely to happen because this is the situation in much of the world now. But an alternative is actually, well, maybe liability should be increased for those people further up the chain. Obviously, if a subcontractor is hiring some workers and he chooses to use these labour contractors, and the labour contractors don't have much money, then they can't really be sued, they can't really be charged. But the subcontractor who's hired the labour could actually be liable for the payment of wages. And then, of course, eventually it should be those at the top of the chain who bear some responsibility. And this is something which is now happening in many parts of the world that are much more advanced, developed, if you like, than the countries in the Gulf. In the United States, in the European Union, it is now increasingly being recognised that there is liability for higher up the chain from the small companies that are actually directly employing the workers.
That's very interesting about the fact that the main contractors were not understanding what was happening further down their supply chain. I mean, there is a move through the Blue Dot Network to start create a kind of certification network. I mean, if for listeners who do not know, the Blue Dot Network is really supported and funded by the US administration, Japan, slight of tongue there, Japan and Australia, and is being overseen by the OECD. And they're trying to create a certification process for really private investment in infrastructure and around the what's known as the quality infrastructure investment principles. And they're looking to create a certification system scheme for individual projects. But then I think it's great that Labour is being talked about quite prominently and is being pushed through the US administration, have raised it as an issue and linked it to corruption in the sector. But how, Joe, have you got any suggestions about, is it possible to certify kind of payment of wages to workers and other kind of labour standard issues? Or what kind of regime can we create to kind of really push the barrier around standards, around making sure workers are paid and are working in good conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. Most people think about labour standards as being the sort of physical conditions in which workers are housed or in which they actually work. But the way in which they're employed and the remuneration they get for that employment, for that work, is the most critical thing in my view. I think at a project level, many big projects now, for example, in the United Kingdom, we've been talking about the Gulf, we've been talking about developing countries, but these situations are still very, very apparent in the most developed countries in the world. In the United Kingdom, there has been a tendency to try very hard to ensure that the majority of workers are employed more directly, either by the main contractor or by the subcontractors. There will be numerous subcontractors on any project, and direct employment by subcontractors was pushed very hard during the construction of the Olympic Games. It is currently the situation in the construction of the nuclear power plant in Hinkley Point in Somerset. And absolutely all workers on the Hinkley Power plant, which is an isolated part of the countryside, so it's quite isolated from the rest of the economy. All the workers there are employed directly by the contractors and by their subcontractors. The cost, of course, is higher, but the great key question is the quality higher? I mean, it's certainly going to avoid the kinds of problems that arise when labour is not directly employed, and all the possibilities of strikes and industrial unrest. So I think the first point would be, all workers should be directly employed if clients are not content to pay the extra cost this involves. Then certainly the liability of the client and the main contractors should be to ensure that everybody is paid. If that liability is shifted up the chain, then there are all sorts of steps that contractors can take to make sure that workers are being properly paid. They can demand on a monthly basis to see the paychecks of the workers. It is possible to actually check. At the last resort, they can, of course, make sure that there is that hotline. So if pay is delayed, they also have to make sure, of course, that the money is actually passing down the chain to the people who are indirectly employed at the bottom of the chain.
I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, one of the things that also struck me looking at both your papers and one or two others was this whole issue of often there's a legal framework in many countries to support workers, but they're not. The reality is they don't have the power to use that legal framework to be paid, because ultimately they're just a very, very, very small fish the power differentiation is enormous. So I mean, is there anything that can be done to kind of help ensure that workers have the right to redress, can use the legal frameworks available and really make their voice heard?
Ah, it's It varies, of course. You know, we're talking now about the whole world, and every country is different. It's obviously, I mean, the International Labour Organization would make the point that workers, the best way of protecting workers against maltreatment and lack of payment, is for them to join trade unions. But of course, the very situation that's been created by this outsourcing of labour means that it's very, very, very difficult for workers to join a trade union. In some countries, they actually workers who are not employed by a legally constituted organisation are not considered as workers. So it's quite difficult to actually push the issue of joining trade unions, and the traditional employment structure is just sort of broken down in most countries, particularly in the United States, where unions are virtually in construction have just diminished at a fantastic rate, and non-union employment has grown at the same time. So it is very difficult to see how workers can be protected, but trying to recover wages that have not been paid is extremely difficult. Interesting examples are being put together by some Australian academics at the moment on how migrant workers might be assisted to recover their wages once they haven't been paid, and once they're back home in the country from which they were sent. It is very hard, but there are some promising initiatives. But my view would be that it's probably better to look at it the other way around and see how it is possible to prevent. And I think by imposing this liability to clients and to main contractors, sometimes it's hard to know who is the main contractor right now, but certainly clients who have a construction project, or even people investing in a construction project such as the World Bank, should be capable of setting up systems that are incentivizing clients and the main contractors to actually make sure that wages are being paid.
Great, Jill. I think that's gives us a suitable point to wrap up this conversation. I think really highlighting, you know, this hugely important point about making sure there is a much more strengthened framework for liability and ensuring workers are paid. As well. So, Jill, thank you very much for your time. I hope everyone listening enjoyed our conversation, and hopefully we'll be able to do this again. The podcast is available on the EAP website, and there'll be hopefully others on the EAP website as well very, very soon.